Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past 2022 season. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ANRA Historical Novel Prize 2021, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ANRA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000, divided between the adult and CYA categories. Jock Sarong's novels have received high praise, the Ned Kelly Award for First Fiction, the Colin Roderick Award, and the inaugural Staunch Prize. His novel, The Burning Island, the second part of a trilogy based in the Furneaux Islands, won the ARA Historical Fiction Prize Adult Category 2021. When organising this interview, I asked Jock how his writing was going. He said the words were flowing like Texas crude, lumpy, slow and dark, and possibly a value with heavy refining. Whilst I was happy Jock's words slurped into the barrel, I was disturbed we were still using a petrochemical metaphor. I hope today we can get Jock's words purring like a well-tilted solar panel. Welcome Jock Sarong to HNSA Imagining the Past 2022 podcast series.
Thanks, Greg.
What was your first inkling to actually become a writer?
I don't know that it's ever something you can trace to a point. I think it's intrinsic, and that you know as a kid that you're a storyteller. All kids are storytellers, but that you know that you want to build stories throughout your life, and that I guess you're looking for a medium in which to do it. And some people who are intrinsically storytellers might go off and make films or write songs or do other things. But for me, it was always about writing it down. And I remember when I was about, 13 or 14, I had this real self-consciousness about my own handwriting, that it kind of embarrassed me writing stories. So I bought a typewriter and I would sit in my bedroom and pummel away on this typewriter, which I don't think in retrospect really helped at all.
Your first three novels were set pretty much in the present day. I'm just wondering what shifted you towards historical fiction.
I think I've always been very interested in historical stories, and if anything, I feel more comfortable in that milieu than I do in writing the present. And for me, that's very much a function of place. When I think about the Furneaux Islands, it's hard not to be struck by the present because they're so incredibly beautiful. But there is always a very strong sense wherever you go in those islands that the past is whispering to you all the time. And I suppose in wanting to write about the Furneaux Islands, the only real way I could think to approach it was to write about the past. So the islands themselves took me backwards rather than me making a conscious decision that I wanted to write history.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite a shift though. So were your present day novels kind of, you know, without wanting to stretch too far, were they kind of more about yourself, do you think? And do you feel like by writing about the past, you can create a distance between yourself as author and character?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, actually. If I look at the first three novels, the first one was a pretty conventional crime story in which the main character was probably me, as happens to a lot of people when they write their first novel. They find themselves exploring their own life in some way. The second one was, again, probably me writing out my obsession with cricket, and there's all sorts of elements of my family life in that novel. And then the third one was me being furious about the way we treat asylum seekers and wanting to explore that. So, yes, there was an element of kind of self-regard in those three novels. And exactly as you said, when I came to writing about the Furneaux Islands, I was liberated to write about a place and to invent people to inhabit the place. And maybe also that comes with growing confidence as a writer, that you feel more at liberty to step away from your own life experience and to invent other life experiences.
Well, and also you develop the ability to inhabit other subjective positions, which is, I always think, is the primary job of a writer, is to take a reader into another subjective position.
Yes, and when you're writing historical fiction, that's such an interesting exercise because it involves that central debate over whether people 200 years ago were different people or whether they were exactly the same people, just dressed in funny clothes. And I prefer that position. I prefer to think that the things that animate us and the loves and hates and grudges and jealousies and greeds that we carry through our lives are exactly the same and they're universal and they never change, but that what changes is the subject matter upon which they're played out.
And also the way that they're interpreted. I think, one of the things someone like Shakespeare did is, he, in a way, he's kind of prefigured modern psychology and modern psychiatry because he understood human nature so well that he could see the fault lines and where things were dysfunctioning. And I think it's always interesting when you're writing a character to try and actually get a modern medical diagnosis for them and then work back from that.
Yes, and it's remarkable how often you write characters and you write their struggles and their peculiarities, and then long after you've set all that down, you discover that you are writing straight into quite a universal trope or a commonly recognized diagnosis. And it's because of that universality that if you've got your eyes and ears open, if you've got your antennae up, you tend to strike upon things that are widely recognized.
So what was the first glimpse you had of this trilogy? There's Preservation, The Burning Island, and I think there's almost a third in the barrel to go. So what was
the
beginning? What was the inspiration?
So the beginning was this, that I have a long-term association with the Furneaux Islands that goes back to being about 20. And as we discussed, I wanted to write about the physical place and I wanted to write about its history. And I worked out a little theory that there was a 50-year window during which the islands were incredibly important to the process of colonization in southeastern Australia. So starting in 1797 with the wreck of the Sydney Cove, which is the subject matter of Preservation, there's 50 years of sealers, and then there's George Augustus Robinson bringing the survivors of the Tasmanian genocide onto the island, onto Flinders Island. And by 1847, that settlement has collapsed. So there's a 50-year window in which a lot of stuff happens. And prior to that point, the islands were in this kind of deep sleep. They were undiscovered by Europeans and they were rarely used by Aboriginal people. And after 1847, they seemed to return to that slumber again for a very, very long time. So I knew I had a 50-year window to talk about. And at first I thought I could cram that into one character's lifetime. That was the first challenge. And when I started writing the story, which became Preservation, I very quickly worked out that there was far too much to tell for it to be one novel or indeed one character's lifetime. So that was what gradually teased it out into three separate volumes.
Well, I'm interested with The Burning Island, your process to arrive. It's a first-person narrative and it's a female protagonist. I'm just like, we're almost three pages into the novel, I think, before it's revealed, definitely, where a man says back to her, "Of course, miss." So it's the first solid hint that we have that the narrator is a woman. I'm just wondering kind of what that process was that you arrived at that decision to inhabit that point of view.
Yeah, well, in part, it flows from the way that Preservation ends, without giving too much away about what does happen there, but I had a range of characters to work with to start the second book, and I was looking for a perspective that would be, for want of a better term, fish out of water. I wanted somebody to voyage into these islands, a little bit like Heart of Darkness. I wanted a character to be a foreigner in a strange land. And I mean that both in the sense of the geography, but also in terms of the inner psychology of it. So the very best way I could think of to do that was to take somebody who had lived a very sheltered, focused life up to that point, a very one-dimensional life, and to be thrown into this chaotic realm. And there was an infant media in Sydney at the time, that the Sydney Gazette was maybe 20 years old, and they were having a great time depicting the Furneaux Islands as this lawless realm where there were anarchists and escapees and murderers and shipwreckers. So for Eliza to go into that place as a governess who had worked in the home of wealthy people, and she was an only child, she'd lost her mother, she had very little experience of anything outside that narrow life that she was living. And once you take all those things in combination, she's really the perfect vantage point from which to tell the story.
Was it hard to find Eliza's voice, and what kind of experiments did you conduct to kind of, you know, spiral down into that?
Yeah, I think writing any of these novels, you start out with all of your characters sounding more or less the same, and it's only with successive drafts that they start to distinguish themselves from each other. So I probably didn't have a distinctive look and feel for Eliza at the outset, but that as the story built up around her, I was more able to get a sense of how she might bounce off the other characters. And I liked the idea that she would have an edge of sarcasm about her, and a bit of evident frustration with her father and with other men. That was part of the fun of finding that unique voice for Eliza.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you were at risk of giving her a little too much agency. There's a couple of scenes I felt where she, like, there's once when she's near the beginning, she's in a marketplace, I think, and some man makes a comment and she turns around and says, "Let me know if you see one." Like, she's very on the ball. I'm just wondering if you felt that, you know, you had to really maintain a very fine balance.
Yes. And I think this applies with any historical fiction writing, that there is a challenge between, on the one hand, maintaining historical verity and observing the mores of the time and the manners and the patterns of speech and getting those things very authentic, and on the other hand, talking in ways that are appealing to a modern reader so that they don't feel bogged down. And so it has to be sharp, but on the other hand, it has to have integrity. And you're right, comments like that from Eliza are right on the edge of that precipice. I thought that maybe one justification for that is that Eliza is very much in old maid territory by this stage of her life. She's looking after her father.
31.
Yeah, exactly. and that perhaps once the people around you have labelled you that way in such a society, then you feel a little more at liberty to answer back. If you're a 17-year-old girl of marriageable prospects in this society, then you'd be extremely careful to mind your P's and Q's. But if you've hit 32 and the men in the town have decided that you're yesterday's news, then perhaps you'd be a bit more frank about the way you feel.
Mm. And you've maintained the single point of view all the way through the novel, and it's written in past tense, which I always appreciate. I'm just wondering what you gained through choosing those things. And I think this relates back to some of the questions about your earlier work, which were crime and thrillers. I often kind of feel like a first person point of view really aids the telling of a crime and a thriller kind of story, because there's restrictions around that.
Yeah, it's one of the things that surprises me is how little thought goes into this. It almost appears to be instinctive that a story needs to be presented from a particular angle. And it's not something I debate a lot in the early stages. I guess that writing crime and writing thrillers, because the action and the urgency is so important, the use of first person and present tense races you through and keeps you on the hook as a reader. Here, where I wanted a contemplative kind of mood, I wanted room to think about the physical atmosphere and to think about the sea and the sky and these things, I think putting it in the past tense allows a little bit more space for that meditative feel. You don't want things hurtling forward in a story like this one.
Yeah, I'm just thinking though too of the first person point of view really does. But you know, one character, you're seeing it through one character's eyes, so a lot of the other motivations of a lot of other characters and thoughts can't be revealed. But in this type of novel, I really think that aids the author because it helps you create tension. Because if you're changing point of view and going into other characters' points of view, then their feelings are revealed.
I was going to say the other thing that it does is that sometimes it places a wedge between the narrator and the reader, because as the reader, you may have particular feelings or misgivings about Dr. Gideon, which poor Eliza hasn't yet latched onto. And, you know, there's that feeling of he's behind you, which you want to yell at her, but she's not yet seen it. And that can be an interesting tension to play with.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. I think it's really slightly underrated in that people feel a need to have this kaleidoscope view, you know, of what's happening. But I think that comes at costs. Like every move you make in a novel comes at a cost, I guess. But I think often it's forgotten that not having revelation is actually an aid to tension.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's funny, I've read a series of recent Australian novels in a row where the structure is that the present tense is told, for instance, in third person past, and then there's flashback chapters in first person present, and they're sometimes presented in a different font, and the chapters are identified by character names so that you're supposed to be flashing between these screens. And I think it's probably a screen-driven idea that this is a way to segment the story, and frankly, I find it a little distracting.
Well, I wonder too if it comes from movie and television that we're so used to, you know, having that kind of head-hopping thing happening in film, you know, whether that is being kind of forced onto the novel.
Yeah, and as you are identifying, the benefit of staying in one person's head throughout is that you allow space for their realization and their understanding to grow very gradually. So Eliza here is a fish out of water. She's doing something extremely foreign and difficult. And as the journey goes on and its complexity grows, her responses to that complexity are sometimes surprising. She surprises herself. And that's a very gradual process of revelation, which I guess you can't have if you're flashing in and out of her perspective.
Mm. I'm just wondering what the process of engaging with the Tasmanian First Nations people, how you went about that and how it was working with them, with that group of people.
Yeah, I suppose I start from the basic principles that I need to research and I need to consult and I need to check. So yeah. I read as much as I could. And of the three novels in this series, this one offered the least documentary backing. There's really not very much written about this period at all. But I found what I could and I read up. And then once I was armed with what I thought was a pretty good basic understanding, I started to talk to descendants, and there are descendants to be found. There's a strong community at the corner on Cape Barron Island. There's a First Nations community on Flinders Island. There are representative organisations. So I tried to cast as widely as I could amongst them and to take on board the comments that they had. It's difficult because there are clear divisions and fault lines among descendants, and it means that it's very, very hard to steer a line between diametrically opposed positions about history. And I hope that one of the outcomes of novels like this one is that people are encouraged to go off and do their own research and form their own views about the merits of various interpretations, because the interpretations are radically different in some instances.
Well, I think that's another fault with this kind of debate, is that to go into this debate thinking that there's just one, you know, First Nations opinion about everything, like, that is, you know, just runs completely counter to the whole kind of evidence of,
yes,
you know, people over such a huge, vast land that were isolated and would have had significantly different cultural practices and significantly different ways of reading the world and history.
Yeah, and one of the things that you learn about writing about Tasmanian history is the level of specificity that you need, that there are small clan groups among nations within the island of Tasmania and within those outlying islands. And there's absolutely no point going away and finding yourself a generic Aboriginal person. It's just insulting. And people who are prominent academics or writers among First Nations people must be constantly frustrated by the approaches which are simply driven by, I need to find an Aboriginal person. Mm. It's as foolish as somebody writing about contemporary Sydney and going to London to find a white person to explain it to them. It's... Yeah. There's a level of care and hard work that's required that is sometimes not done to standard.
So how much work had you actually done on the novel before you approached the First Nations groups? Because, you know, you hear these horror stories of people having novels completely finished and then showing them to someone and, you know, having huge problems and having to restructure and rewrite things. So how much work had you actually done, or had you actually started writing, or had you just kind of done the research and formed some ideas?
Both. There's a descendant who is an academic named Patsy Cameron, who I went to early on to ask questions about how to tell the story, having read her book, and then I went back to her once the story was written. I think, in fairness to people who you consult, it's not a bad approach to have a draft written, so that you can say, this is the story I want to tell. Can you show me where I've gone wrong? Rather than just sort of wondering out loud about what story you might tell, I think that places too much of an onus on the person you're consulting.
Mm.
So I try to be able to have something to show when I'm consulting. But the thing that I've learned across the three novels is the enormous importance of starting the process early, because it can take a lot of time to work your way towards the right people and to have some consideration of those people's lives, that they might have pressures in their own lives whereby they can't sit down and read 80,000 words of your writing and give you a view, that it might take quite a long time for them to come back with their response, which is entirely fair. So by starting early, you allow more room for that process to occur. The process is more of a to and fro. It's more of a feedback, and you can respond and nobody's put under pressure. But that's a technique that, you know, was kind of hard learned in my case. I made mistakes and had to improve.
Well, I think this goes back to what you were saying right back at the beginning of our discussion about redrafting. You know, as a writer, if you don't like redrafting, then you're kind of in the wrong job, because, you know,
yeah,
it really takes so long to hone it down. And it is all about incorporating other ideas from people.
Yeah, it really is. It's distillation. The actual writing of the thing is a relatively quick and painless process. You just tip out everything that's in your head. It's the distilling and the getting rid of... It's the filtering out of the static and the white noise and the rubbish. That's the slow part.
It's often about making decisions about what to chuck rather or what not to do rather than what to do.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Richard Flanagan's PhD was published as a book called A Terrible Beauty. Thank you, William Butler Yeats. And in that, he argued the concept that the concept of wilderness was flawed with its evocations of spaces that have never been exploited by humanity. And so therefore they should be kind of left alone. Like he argued that Tasmanian First Nations people had tilled the land even, you know, down into the remote southwest. So the whole concept of that area being untouched was kind of flawed. But with the arrival of European explorers, the Tano group was largely uninhabited. So there must have been, it was exploited by the sealers and the mutton birders who were really there for just a quick profit. So there must have been kind of a huge environmental consequence of this arrival on the island.
Yeah, there was. It's interesting with the Furneaux group because there were some archaeological digs on Flinders and Primes in the early 70s, I think it was University of Sydney, which found evidence of occupation about 18,000 years old. So you have that process of the flooding and emptying of the Bassian Plain and Tasmania being linked to mainland Australia, at which times the Furneaux group would have been mountaintops. So even allowing for First Nations people crossing the Bassian Plain, it seems logical to say that they would have travelled along the path of least resistance and not gone over the tops of the mountains. But there is material evidence in the islands at a number of points. But really, owing to the damage that we've done as colonisers, it's very unclear what the nature of that occupation was and when it started and finished. That's the first point I think to make about that. In terms of environmental damage, yes, that early rush in the 50-year window that I'm talking about was enormously destructive. And there were five endemic species of seal in Bass Strait when the sealers turned up. By the time they were done, within 30, 40 years, there were only two left. They had rendered three species locally extinct. They then went on, as we know, to do enormous damage to whale stocks. The mutton birding, interestingly, has a First Nations dimension to it as well as a settler dimension, and it has proven reasonably resilient over the years. Although any migratory seabird is now under different kinds of pressures from the loss of habitat along their migratory path. But the harvesting seems to have been sustainable. The interesting thing, going back to preservation and to the journey of the Sydney Cove survivors up into New South Wales, was that those survivors also found coal and they found timber. And when they reached Sydney and reported this, that led to something of a commercial rush back onto that coast. So the damage that was done by the settling of the Furneaux group also extended into New South Wales. It's that sort of ripple effect of any discovery, isn't it?
Mm. It's would the islands as they are, I haven't been to them, but would they have been able to have sustained if a population after the rise of Bass Strait, would people have actually been able to live there in sufficient number?
It's a really interesting question. I couldn't answer that other than to say one of the fundamental problems when George Augustus Robinson tried to strike a settlement on Flinders was that there was no standing water. Mm. They get their share of rainfall, I suppose, but there's no significant streams and reservoirs on those islands, and that would have been the biggest problem for them.
Yeah.
The isolation is significant. The islands are sufficiently spread on Bass Strait, and they're sufficiently far from both major landforms that would have been a challenge, I think, for anybody.
Oh, I think commuting would have been pretty much impossible, particularly given Bass Strait's pretty volatile piece of water, really.
Yeah, it is. It's shallow and very weather affected. And, you know, it's interesting even now being on Flinders Island, you have this sense that there's one type of weather coming at you from the Roaring Forties from the southwest, and there's an entirely different type of weather coming at you from the Tasman. And they carry with them, you know, different insects in the air, and the plants behave differently in response. That's why, to me, it's such an interesting natural world, that it's subject to these two major influences.
Yeah, no, that is a very good point. It's being in the middle there. I mean, you know, Tasmania is definitely has the same thing, but it's on the west coast. You've got, you know, the weather coming from Africa, and on the east coast, it's a completely different weather system. But those islands, it would be so noticeable. Well, how was writing the second part of the series as a standalone?
Yeah, it's funny. I had to learn this. My friend Mark Smith writes young adult novels, and we're with the same publisher. And he used to talk to me about the fact that you have to be very, very conscious of the arc of each of the characters and their aging and what you've already built up or locked in place about them, and ensuring that you maintain those values as you go ahead. And because each of us is talking about our work at various times in front of rooms or on podcasts, you have to be very careful that what you're talking about is current to what the reader understands, not what you're working on in your office, because you're always a couple of years ahead of what the public can see. So there are those sorts of strange constraints that you have to be conscious of. And I'd written three standalone novels up to this point, and I didn't ever encounter these problems. And then when you write a series, and when you write the middle novel of a series, those things have to be front of mind all the time. And one of the reasons I like writing fiction is that I'm a fairly inattentive person, and I'm happy being lost in these worlds. But close attention to that sort of continuity detail is not my strong point at all.
But had you planned out that, I mean, you mentioned that you started writing and realized you had more information than you could put in one novel, but had you kind of planned the three out before Preservation came out, or were you just winging it as you went along?
As I said earlier, I had that 50-year window in mind, but even within the 50 years, there are a large variety of points at which you could put the pin in the map and say, this is going to be my storytelling. So it might be clear enough that the 50 years starts with the wreck of the Sydney Cove in 1797, and that I could write about the wreck. And it might be equally clear that it ends at the closure of the Wibelina settlement in 1847, and that I could write about Wibelina. But within that period, there are all these choices to make. So if you look at Wibelina, it operated from 1833 to 1847. And a number of really important things happened within the life of the settlement in that handful of years. So I had to think about, in writing the third novel, I've had to think about, okay, where exactly in Wibelina's lifespan are we going to set the action? And with the Burning Island, there's a really wide area to cover, in that there were two separate waves of sealers that came through the Furneaux Islands. And I wanted to write about the sealers and the way that they interrelated with First Nations women, and the way that Sydney viewed them as these far-off outlaws. I wanted to depict all that stuff. But if you put it later towards 1830, which is what I've done, you're able to bring in the influence of Robinson traveling around the islands, rounding people up, and the pressure to close down those settlements. If you'd pitched it earlier, you'd have much more of a dark Western kind of feel, where it's just these lawless men in the islands essentially doing as they please.
Well, it does have that feeling almost of some Pirates of the Caribbean in a way. This kind of, I mean, you really did evoke the character of those, that group of islands. I thought that, and that was really exciting, because there's something I don't know about. There's something, well, I've known Alston, but I've never been there and don't know much of their history. So it was a great thing for historical fiction to do, to be able to do that. I'm always interested in the research, which was clearly a huge part of this endeavor. Did you have some really great finds along the way that really stand out?
Yeah, there are things that you discover essentially by accident that are always the fun ones. And you might go into the archive looking for one thing and come back with something entirely different. And then you find yourself trying to bend the story to accommodate this thing that you found, rather than it be a case of finding the research that backs up the story you already wanted to tell. I remember here I had discovered these references to a fungus that affects rye crops called St. Anthony's Fire. And I don't know what I was looking for when I found it, but I started reading about it and I thought, this is fascinating. How can this work somehow into what I'm doing? And if you look very closely at The Burning Island, there's an episode in there which involves St. Anthony's Fire getting into the rye crops on the island. And it's there because I found it and it fascinated me, not because it originally fitted with what I was doing. There are interesting rumors about the shipwreck that is the historical basis of this novel was a ship called the Britomart, which actually sank 9 years after the year that I've set the novel. But there are all sorts of strange rumors about the Britomart as to whether it was deliberately wrecked, whether the survivors were then murdered, and even whether it was carrying bullion to establish a bank in Tasmania. And none of these things is really clear because there was only the Sydney Gazette at the time and it wasn't terribly reliable. So it's really fun to speculate with things like that, and those can be the real joys of the research.
Mm. And down to, I mean, there's the macro things and then down to the micro things that, you know, fascinate me is, like, how did you arrive at the name Howrah for the boat that is lost that you substituted for the
Britomart?
Yeah.
Yeah. Howrah is the city across the Hooghly River from Calcutta. So if you go back to Preservation and the opening scenes at Fort William in Calcutta, the shipping line, Campbell and Clark, the merchants, they had their distilleries for spirits over at Howrah across the Hooghly River. So a lot of the alcohol that was found on the wreck of the Sydney Cove when it was discovered was alcohol that had been distilled in Howrah. So it was a kind of elliptical reference to that.
And a suburb in Hobart across.
Oh, there you go. I didn't know that. Yeah, across the river.
On the eastern shore of Hobart. So, you know, across from the main city of Hobart.
That's fascinating.
I understand you're working on the third part of this trilogy. How far along are you with that? And what's going to happen once you finish this trilogy?
So it's well and truly written and bedded down now. We're about to start editing. The long process that we talked about of First Nations consultation and approvals is still ongoing. We're now about 4 months out from release, so we're about 2 months out from printing. When that's out and done, I'm already two-thirds of the way through the novel beyond that one and about a third of the way through the novel after that. So there's, you know, this constant process of trying to build up the work as it's being released so that you don't have long gaps and shadows. I feel like the work after completion of these three Furneaux Island novels is very different, and I think part of that is a reaction against what I've been doing for 5 years or so. That very, very careful process of research and sifting and consulting. The novels that I'm writing now seem to be more surreal. They're more contemporary. They're probably not as heavy. And part of that, I imagine, is me letting go. I try not to think about it too much. I try to just do the writing. But, yeah, it's a pretty different experience.
So will you return to historical fiction again, do you think, at some stage?
Yeah, I'm sure I will, but it won't be a deliberate thing. I think the inception of any of these novels is always a story that grabs you. And a story can grab you for a whole lot of different reasons. One of them might be its historical depth, but there might be any number of other reasons. So while I would never say I'm deliberately, consciously a historical fiction writer, I'd also never rule it out.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to have that freedom you move around. I mean, it's what keeps the writing alive for you as well.
Yeah. I don't know that I'd want to be marketing the novels because they don't ever seem to sit still. But that's someone else's problem.
And you won the 2021 ARA Historical Fiction Prize. That was a huge thing. So what did that mean to you, and what do you feel the role of these prizes are?
Well, I thought Evelyn Araluen said an interesting thing the other day when she won the Stella Prize, which was that the funding of the arts is so bad in this country and it's so hard to make a living that writers find themselves hoping for prizes to put together a salary over the course of a year. And I think her point was that that's artificial and there's an element of chance to it and it's not good enough. So there is a strange conundrum here whereby when you win a prize, you're incredibly grateful. And I am incredibly grateful for having that support. On the other hand, we all wish that there was government support, that there was more of a recognizable career for writers so that you don't have to hope for prizes. It's financially tough, and the telling of stories, the telling of historical stories is more important than ever because as communication, as media and social media accelerates and concentrates, we all see the pathologies that start to emerge, the twisting of truth. And we really need as a society to have people going back into the past looking for lessons and looking for ways of thinking. Historical fiction's more needed than it ever was, I think.
Well, thank you for your time today. I've really enjoyed our chat.
Yeah, thanks very much, Greg. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2022 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many illuminary. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction, including details of the announcement of the 2022 ARA Historical Novel Prize on the 20th of October, 2022. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.